Right, let's begin. Blinking lights, friend or foe, a history of SciTown text for the ages. First of all, who am I? I'm a security consultant at WhipSecure. I'm also a CTF player for Cameron Union. And I'm also a Bon Hack participant here in the Pyjamas Camp. So a quick TLDR, what is this talk gonna cover? First of all, if you were expecting it to be about the hit 2000 movie Blinken og Lygter, it's sadly not gonna be about that, but it is a good movie. What we're gonna talk about first is, what are side channel attacks? A history of the side channel attacks starting around in the 1940s going up to the 80s. We're gonna talk about a bunch more side channel attacks, how they work, how can we categorize them, why attacks like these pop up, and why they matter. So first of all, what is a side channel attack? And this is the formal definition you'll find if you go on Wikipedia. It's a side channel attack is any attack based on extra information that can be gathered because of that fundamental way a computer protocol or algorithm is implemented, rather than flaws in the design of the protocol or algorithm itself. I don't agree with this definition. For me, it's just any attack based on information gathered in a fundamental way because of how the system is implemented. It doesn't have to be on computer protocols or on algorithms. You can do side channel attacks on anything. So start an example, you are a baker in a small town, like Gilstead here, for example, and there opens up a competing baker who starts stealing a lot of your business. You're suddenly every single day throwing bread out because you're making too much, you don't know how many customers you've stolen, and of course, you're a bit mad at him. You can't just go up and ask him, hey, how many people are you selling to? So instead, what you do, you go first in the morning, you go buy a piece of bread from him, first thing, as soon as he opens, and you keep the receipt. End of day, you go back, buy another piece of bread or whatever, and you get the other receipt. You now have two receipts with two order numbers, and you can see exactly how many orders were made in the day. Because on all receipts, order numbers like this are sequential most of the time. There's nothing technical here. It was just a system that was implemented to keep, for the rival baker to keep track of how many orders he's had. You used it for your own advantage to figure out how many customers he's gotten. So we start our story in the Second World War, where this was what side channel attacks started popping up and becoming a thing. So right before D-Day, we had the Panzer V Panther tank. It was new, created by the Germans, and American tanks, it was unknown how effective they were against them. However, they had only been seen in Italy so far, so no stress on that front. However, in the couple days leading up to D-Day, there were suddenly lots of rumors about these tanks appearing in France and Normandy, where the landings would happen. And the Allied forces really needed to know how many tanks are gonna be there. So what did they do? For the tanks they already had destroyed or captured, they started tearing them apart. And inside the gearboxes, the cogwheels were sequentially numbered with their serial numbers. And also importantly, it also had the number of what gear mold produced the cogwheel. Based off this information, they could actually estimate how many tanks have they been able to produce, because they knew how many gear molds they had, and you can't have a tank without a gearbox. And they estimated 270 tanks had been produced in February 1944. And this was substantially higher than any rumors that they had, so this was really important information to get. They could prepare for this. After the war, documents confirmed 276 Panzer V Panther tanks had been produced. They had estimated this just off the serial numbers on gearboxes. This is honestly where I would start saying side channel attacks. This is where they started getting used in military applications or by governments for attackers. There was a system that was introduced without consideration of every single part of it. They didn't consider how could the serial numbers on gears be abused, and it was abused. Next up, we have the 131 B2 Mixer. This was an encrypted teleprinter in use during the Second World War, and it was built off the one-time pad principle. And it was basically built with a whole bunch of electromechanical relays or switches, which turns out they actually gave off quite a bit of electromagnetic radiation. And turns out by observing this information here, you could actually figure out the plain text. And this was actually Alexander Graham Bell of the Bell Telephone Company who discovered this attack. And he researched and he found there was three different radiated signals that were of importance. There was just signals, the standard EMF radiation in the local area. There was noise being carried by the communication wires in which the plain text could be snatched up, and there was through the magnetic fields as well. So we created a new version, the 131A1, which had shielding and filtering and stuff like that, but it was large, it was unwieldy, it didn't really work on the battlefield. Turns out we just implemented a 30-meter perimeter around the thing, and that kind of solved most of the issues, at least made it safe enough to use. However, it turns out later in 1951, the CIA discovered they could retrieve the signals from this half a kilometer away due to the noise being sent through the signals, and we're like, oh no, we gotta fix it because they'd still been using the same system. And then they started developing signal and power line filters. They started isolating it as much as they could, and kind of turned into a cat and mouse game because this machine was also quite loud while it was encrypting. All these switches were triggering. Turns out you could also, through just listening to it, you could extract the plain text as well. So they soundproofed the room and they soundproofed the box and the room was in. Turns out it just made the signals easier to record, so they just created a 100-meter perimeter and said, okay, you know what, let's get onwards with it. We kind of got to get something else. But this is where they were like, oh shit, we got to do something about these signals that are being radiated out. Next up, towards the end of the war in 1944, the Russians and the US were still on good terms there. So a bunch of Russian Boy Scouts, they gifted this lovely wooden seal to the US ambassador in the Soviet Union. And yeah, okay, it's still something gifted by the Soviet Union, you don't really trust it. But they scanned it with nonlinear junction detectors, which basically just search for active electronics. They couldn't find anything. As far as they knew, it was just a piece of wood carved into the US seal there. Keyword was active components. Inside there was a completely passive bug where it consisted of an antenna and a membrane, and the membrane essentially being just a piece of plastic. Sound waves inside the room would vibrate this membrane, which was attached to an antenna. And what happened is this antenna, when you hit it with the right frequency radio signal, it would then resonate and it will give off its own signal, which could be picked up by a radio. And the sound waves would then modulate the people talking within the room this signal onto the repeated signal. And so it turns out they sent a 300 kilohertz signal, I believe it was, to it, and then they could hear everything that was going on inside the ambassador's private quarters, which is quite a lot of information leaked. Turns out then in 1951, a British radio operator at the British Embassy, just down the road, he was listening to open Soviet Air Force radio channels, and suddenly he heard the US ambassador to the Soviet Union talking. Kind of bad, doesn't really work. And turns out, just a couple of fun facts about this. One, it was created by Leon Theremin, the guy who created the Theremin instrument. And it's also essentially how RFID works. You send a radio signal, resonate an antenna, and you get data out from that. But this is where, you know, side channel attacks had begun. Introducing Tempest. Tempest was then a US code word for dealing with side channel attacks. It has then been backronymed to telecommunications electronics material protected from emanating spurious transmissions, and I will not be repeating that. But it's both a set of standards for protecting hardware from leaking signals. It's also just the term for all side channel attacks that the NSA use. It's just attacks that attack systems and not attack it directly, but what's getting leaked out of it. These standards, it leads to development of things such as red-black separation, where there physically has to be a few centimeters separation between red wires and black wires, where black wires carry plain text and red wires carry only ciphertext. And then 1958, first policy regarding EMF radiation standards for military use was put in place. It was adopted, US came with it first, but it was quickly adopted by Canada, UK, and the other allied forces at least. And with the Cold War well underway, like, they really needed to start controlling these signals. Because at the same time, over 900 different listening devices and sensors had been found in US installations behind the Iron Curtain. This was, you could not just ignore Tempest leakages. This was something they had to take care of. This led to a whole bunch of developments, such as what's called inside rooms. So they took an anechoic chamber like this, and they put another room inside of it to avoid any signals leaking out. And we also have rooms like these, which just isolate completely for RF radiation as well. And there was, however, one issue is all the employees of these embassies and they kind of referred to these as the meat lockers because they were really hot, so we just left the door open. kind of ruining the entire tech. But you can buy one, first of all, you can buy one of these boxes for yourself, a couple of million dollars if you want. Second of all, they're not just used for protecting against military attacks. If you do any research regarding radar waves, for example, you're going to be doing it inside one of these rooms. It's essentially a big Faraday cage. But also, if you have an installation where secure numbers are being generated, such as in banking sector, stuff like that, it also occurs within one of these rooms because this security needs to be taken seriously. And so on, this cat and mouse game between both the Americans and the Russians and side channel attacks on both sides continued at least until the 80s, beginning the age of hackers. At least so far, all these attacks, they had been government only. It was required massive amount of resources in that. But the 80s, computers starting to become pretty popular. I'm pretty sure there's several people in the audience who were already playing with their first computers back then. And I'm just going to cut to a BBC video clip from the 80s because it just explains what happened so much better than I ever could.
Ed. The data on this VDU screen is being transmitted all around the studio. And it's being picked up by this receiving system here that's not linked to it in any way at all. It's only £100 worth of equipment, so it's not the greatest picture, and I'll try and stabilize it a bit there. And if I move the aerial, you can see that the information disappears off the screen. Move it back,
this is sadly
and
lost to
it
compression
returns.
The information on
now,
the
all we've got here is an ordinary television set with an aerial and an amplifier and a rather special, if cheap, box of tricks. But we had to go to the Dr. Nair laboratories in Holland to get hold of it. Incidentally, they use this equipment quite legally to investigate this very problem. And they were the only people, excuse me, who we knew who could find out and would admit to having it. Well, we've seen it working in the controlled conditions of the studio, but yesterday we set this up to see how it would work outside.
So at the moment
we're outside an office block in West London, and we found that there's a VDU screen operating about halfway up the building, probably on the 7th or 8th floor. And in fact, it's a letter being typed out on that screen. I can actually read it here. It says, "Dear Mr. Jackson, thank you for your thank you for your letter requesting the use requesting the use of our facilities."
At least stop the video there. But what had happened was someone called Wim van Eck, he had discovered what's called van Eck freaking, and they even said they could do it for £100. Turns out you could actually do it for like 100 kroners worth of equipment. You could read the signals being that were coming off from a CRT monitor remotely from large distances. And this was kind of a big deal because he had done it as a private person with 100 kroners worth of equipment, antenna and something, bought a Radio Shack basically. Everyone thought so far, oh no, attacks like these, it's only governments we need to take care of, threat actors. But it turns out everyone could, and this kind of split the entire field. Everyone's just rushing. And from here, we kind of can't really talk about like historically what side channel attacks come on next, because there are just so many attacks. It's more important to talk about them in general. So for next up here, the implications of aesthetics. Everyone's seen a network switch, and on every single network switch in the world, there is a small activity LEDs there saying what ports are active, or as we like to call them, blinking lights. This led to this lovely sign being created, which it turns out this sign had actually been hanging around IBM computer room since 1955. And it says, "Achtung, alles Lukenspiepers. Das Computermaschine ist nicht für Gefingerpucken und Mittengaben. Ist easy schnappen der Sprengwerken, Blowenfusen und Poppenkorken mit Spritzenpacken. Ist nicht für Gewerken bei das Dumpkopfen, das Rubbernecken. Schützen, kippen, das Kottenpickern, Hans in das Pockets, muss relaxen und watchen das Blinken litten." But back to the diagnostic LEDs, back to the network switch. And let's put yourself in the shoes. You're an engineer that's been tasked to build the network switch, and specifically, you have to create these activity LEDs. We have the pinout here of an Ethernet cable, RJ45 cable, where, of course, you can see there's just RX plus minus. So why don't we just hook the LED directly up to that wire there? And then we don't have to create any fancy electronics to handle to figure out when these ports are active. Does anyone see the problem here? In 2002, Joe Lurie and David A. Umfras, they had a research paper came out titled Information Leakage from Optical Aminations. They had realized you can just record the LED, and that way you can get all the data coming off the cable. Bit of an issue. And this, everyone, when this paper came out, were like, holy shit, we've been idiots. Why did we not think about this? So we're now just going to go talk about the different types of side channel attacks, at least, because there are a lot. And this is generally how they do get categorized. So for timing attacks, if we have this little snippet of code here, which checks passwords, we can see we loop over the correct password and the input. And we check each character if they match. If the character doesn't match, we break. Obviously, what we can do is we can just start checking the first character for every single A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And at one point, we're going to have one of these calls to the password checking function, which is going to take a little bit longer. When we have that one which is a little bit longer, we know we have the correct letter in that position. We go onwards to the next position. This is a timing attack. It's easy to abuse, at least, if you just can get accurate timing out. Next up, we have power monitoring attacks. These are mostly known for the AES differential power analysis attacks. This is whereby looking at the power usage of a CPU doing AES encryption, you can actually extract the key. And honestly, I could talk about power monitoring attacks for absolutely ages. So I realized I just brought the hardware with me here to Bone Hack, and later today, like midnight-ish, gonna hold a very impromptu hardware hacking workshop where we're gonna do a power monitoring attack like this. Next up, we have cache attacks. This was Meltdown and Spectre. These were two attacks which came out in 2018. And for those of you who aren't massive security nerds, you might have heard your security nerd friends talking about this. But essentially, all processors nowadays, back before this attack came out, and they still do it as well, did what's called speculative execution, where they just try to guess what you were going to do next. If you had an if statement, it would execute both branches. Because why wait for user input? We can already get the data ready. Issue was, this meant you could load secrets into cache and then not go down that execution path. And you could then read those secrets out of the cache because the cache didn't get wiped. This could then be used to, example, leak passwords from another browser tab. And quite effectively, these attacks here, they were in charge of massive slowdowns for cloud computing systems. And if you ever start up a VM nowadays, you'll get the option and will often be recommended, if it's just on your own laptop, to disable side channel attack mitigations, which mitigate attacks like these. Next up, we have acoustic attacks, where there's a small video running in the background here. But this is an attack where someone has trained a machine learning model to listen to what's being typed. And you see here, he's running it on his phone. No cable plugged in there. Goes down to the bottom of the screen there. And he just starts recording. Of course, permissions pop up. Starts recording what's being typed. And very quickly, we'll go on here. You'll see he's going to hold up a phone, and it's basically going to be a one-to-one recreation of what he typed. Now, he did train this specifically for his keyboard. However, if you can get enough training data for your victim's keyboard, then you could also easily execute this attack. There's also research out there which suggests you can do acoustic attacks by listening to the stresses in a heatsink that occur from the changing temperatures during encryption. That is my face when I read that. It should not make any sense that it happens, but apparently we can listen to heat sinks and that way gain useful information. There's also software initiated attacks where Rowhammer, a lot of people might have heard of, but if you haven't, what you did is you had your victim row in a memory where you could figure out where this was with some low level Linux knowledge at least. And say, for example, in this victim row, there was the bits being stored which said what permissions you had. Turns out you could then aggressively toggle the rows next to it on and off repeatedly, and it would actually flip bits in the victim row if you didn't have error correcting memory. And you could then, for example, flip bits, and if you got lucky, you suddenly got admin because you flipped the bits correctly. There's also optical attacks, and this is a really fun one because I'm pretty sure someone here at Bone Hack has all the equipment needed. And while we already covered stuff like the looking at activity LEDs on switches, we can also use lasers for optical attacks. So here, by taking a laser pointer, pointing it at a window, and then capturing the reflected beam from the laser on a photocell, attaching, soldering that photocell to an AUX cable, plugging it into your laptop and opening Audacity, you can record what the laser is picking up by what it's pointed at. So if it's pointed at a window, the glass will vibrate, and you could then listen to it from there, from a distance. We also just covered that you can listen to keyboard recording and capture text like that. And lasers can go pretty far if you have a strong laser. Now, just one thing, this is very illegal if you don't have permission to do it. So don't go about just doing it regularly, even though it is that simple. And it also doesn't have to be on a piece of glass that you're recording from. It could be anything that vibrates, so a bag of chips. If you've ever been in a really top secret meeting, there's going to be no recording allowed because you don't actually need the laser pointer. A video of being from the room and something vibrating in the room, like a leaf or a bag of chips or something, that's enough if you have a high enough budget. And that's back in the NSA government level area. Another optical attack, which I like to include because this one was actually covered a lot back in 2019, it was laser-based audio injection on voice-controllable systems. So if you had a smart speaker and you placed it by your window, you could trigger this smart speaker with a laser by doing essentially the opposite of encoding your voice into the laser. And by pointing at the right place on a smart speaker, on specifically on what's called a MEMS microphone, which, again, all these home assistant smart speakers have, you could inject the sound into it from kilometers away. So imagine if you have a nice fancy smart home and you put this smart speaker in your window because it looks nice in the window. Then as me as a thief, I could point my laser at it and I could say, hey, open the garage doors. I have access to your house now. There are also many, many other kinds of side channel attacks. Recently, there was the Satan attack, it's called, where they turned SATA cables into antennas. And then we could get around air gap security by sending the right by encoding the data through the signals coming out of these antennas. There's really no limits to what side channel attacks can do, and there's so many of them. And before people ask, yes, data exfiltration is still a side channel attack. You're still abusing this system in a way it was supposed to gain information. In this case, it's just to get information out, but you're still gaining information. So what can we learn from all of this? Systems are hard to implement. And if there's a design consideration, for example, stamping the gear mold serial number onto a cog on a tank so you can track down defects in production, it can be abused. Ifs can be if you send out any IDs from your web app, who knows what. And for the love of God, use someone else's cryptographic libraries. And this is what people mean when they say don't roll your own crypto. Because they have been, other people's libraries have hopefully been tested for these kinds of side channel attacks, and you can minimize it. Because there's a lot of these attacks, like the timing attacks and power monitoring attacks, that are quite easy to do, and it doesn't take more of an afternoon to learn how to do it. If you want some further reading, I can highly recommend Silence on the Wire by Michael Zaleski. Great book, talks in general just about side channel attacks. There's also Art of Intrusion by Kevin Mitnick. Not so much about side channel attacks, but does have a quite cool cryptographic attack on a slot machine in a casino they talk about, and how they could predict the random number generator. And there's also The Cuckoo's Egg by Clifford Stahl, which is just a great book about hacking. Not really too much about side channel attacks in it. Thank you for coming to my talk. I'll be putting the slides up on my website at some point. I just need to fix some attribution stuff a little bit there. You want to follow me on Untappd, because that's really the most important communication media. You can follow me there. And there's just a CTF flag. Just ignore that. It's going to be used in like 90 days or so. Thank you.
Thanks. Are there any questions?
What is the best way to introduce some noise to make this less effective?
Introduce some noise to
make it less effective.
make it less effective? It depends on your threat model. I mean, depends on what you're building, of course. Starters don't use sequential IDs. You can always guess those because we're sequential. But again, if you are using some, say we have a cryptographic system running on a processor that you made your own, this can be making sure that you have some background tasks running and make sure power usage is linear and you can record that. You can make sure that you add just some, make sure the program has run for X amount of seconds at least, no matter how fast it runs, to avoid timing attacks, stuff like that. Again, it depends on your threat model, and there are just so many attacks, so you can't really add noise for every single thing. You cannot fully protect yourself from side channel attacks. You can't fully protect yourself from any kind of attack, really. Security is always about knowing your risk and doing what you can to defeat that risk. As we were I was talking about the Tempest rooms that they made, the rooms inside rooms. This was a large, extreme security measure, but it was just too inconvenient for users to use, so they left the doors open. This is what we mean when we say security is a bit of a balance. You can't just go all out, make an unhackable system, because there's always a more dedicated hacker, and there's always users you have to deal with.
No, in that case, thanks a lot.